Good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Where does Ebola originate? How does it spread? What should governments do to stop it? And what role do the media play in helping bring an epidemic under control or in making it worse? Few people understand the answers to these questions better than my next guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Lori Garrett. She's now Senior Fellow for Global Health Council on Foreign Relations, best-selling author of several books, including The Coming Plague, The Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health, and most recently, Ebola, The Story of an Outbreak. Garrett has been a widely sought media commentator on the Ebola crisis, as well as the recent measles outbreak. She's also a former award-winning science reporter for NPR, and she will be the speaker for the 12th Co-College Contemporary Issues Forum on Tuesday, March 17th. Lori Garrett joins us for this half hour. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Now, let's talk about Ebola first, if we could. Some 10,000 people having been killed by Ebola, an infection infecting around 25,000. The Ebola outbreak appears to be running out of steam. What's your view of the containment of Ebola now?
Well, I think it's a very different situation in each of the three key countries. From my observation on the ground and from all the data I'm able to crunch, I think Liberia does indeed have it under control. They've seen no new cases now for several days in a row. And now their problem is ensuring that it doesn't get reintroduced from its neighbors across the border. Guinea has had an up and down roller coaster epidemic from the very beginning, more than a year ago in December 2013. And it's hard to tell if the roller coaster is permanently going down now or is going to come back up again. Sierra Leone was shocking for me. It's not in any way the kind of response I was expecting to see, but in part because it has a legacy of very, very deep government corruption. And indeed, some of the Ebola funds have gone missing. And it seemed there were a lot of people, too many in government, who felt that the whole Ebola epidemic was more of a great boondoggle for their personal wealth than an epidemic that they ought to stamp out. So Sierra Leone's epidemic has taken the longest to bring under control, though I believe WHO and United Nations experts feel that it is really on the permanent downswing.
So government corruption, a factor that made the epidemic, the outbreak in those three West African countries worse. You write about in your latest...
I didn't say in all three countries.
Okay, in one country.
I stipulated one country.
Okay.
I mean, it's, I think, very, very bad to paint the countries with one brush.
They're all right.
Very, very different places, even though they share, more than a decade of civil war that went on in throughout the 90s and into the early 2000s and had devastating impact on all three countries.
You write about how superstition and fear contributed to this Ebola epidemic. Explain that a little.
Well, it's superstition and fear is on all sides of the Atlantic in this case. We certainly had our superstitions and fears that contributed to pretty irrational statements and actions taken by some of our political leaders. Over there, quite a number of issues to consider. The first is that in some, particularly in the rural areas, in some communities, the illiteracy rate is very high, in excess of 50%. And that means that people have never heard about or learned of what we call the germ theory of disease. So, you know, going and talking about watch out for a virus is sort of like, you know, going into the middle of some place in the Middle Ages and saying, look out, the drones are coming. This is compounded by a very different notion of where diseases come from and what are the responsibilities of survivors to deal with those who die. So in all three countries, in different ways, different permutations, and with Liberia being the majority Christian country, the other two being majority Muslim, you have this overlayer of beliefs that precede the arrival of these Western religions. The first is a notion that disease is visited upon you by someone you have angered or your ancestor angered, and they have conjured spirits to cause you illness in revenge for things that were done against them. And that means that protecting yourself from these spirits can involve sending other spirits, ahead to somebody else, many, many things, but not necessarily the same measures that a public health person would say about protecting yourself against the Ebola virus. And the other part of this is that you can anger the long-lasting spirit of your deceased loved one if you do not perform all the proper procedures before burial and during burial, the proper rituals to send them on into the afterlife. If you don't do it right, they won't get to the afterlife, and their ghost may haunt you. Their spirit may devastate you. Your crops may fail. Your daughter may be barren. Your goats may die, and so on. And so you had two sets of very, very deeply entrenched, thousands of year old belief sets that actually end up, in the case of Ebola, running directly contrary to appropriate public health measures to protect people.
On this side of the Atlantic, Lori Garrett, you mentioned irrational things happening, irrational statements and actions by politicians, I guess, here in the U.S. Point to what you saw as the most irrational statements and actions.
Well, I think, without a doubt, it was putting poor Casey Hickox, the nurse who had returned from volunteering in the Ebola epidemic in Sierra Leone, in a tent in a parking lot at the beginning of winter in New Jersey, without running water and so on. Governor Chris Christie commanded it and to this day defends the action, even though she was never infected and posed no threat to anybody. And then poor Casey went on to her home in Maine and suffered apparently quite a number of stigmatizing things from her neighbors in Maine and ended up giving up on her home and moving to a third location. I find the whole episode of how we treated people who selflessly volunteered to put their life in danger to try and save others overseas, how they were treated upon return as if they were evil, as if they were disease carriers, really hideous. It didn't show the best side of America. And it didn't display the kind of American spirit that you think of when you think of Clara Barton and the great pioneers of the Red Cross in America. It was really disturbing.
Give me your critique of the media's coverage of Ebola.
Well, my favorite moment was when CNN had two talking heads yammering about Ebola, and the banner across the screen was Ebola colon equal to ISIS question mark. And of course we had all manner of media claims that from Thomas Duncan, the individual who traveled from Liberia not knowing he was infected, having performed Good Samaritan acts in Liberia that resulted in his getting exposed to someone's Ebola when he tried to help her get to a hospital. When he came down with the disease in Dallas and it spread from he to two healthcare workers, the reactions from so much of the media, particularly sort of talk show pundit types, alleged experts, was just so over the top, so completely extreme. I mean, I had hate mail. I had people saying that I was trying to infect America, that I was trying to kill America, because I was calling for people to calm down. The level of fearfulness was so completely disproportionate to the actual threat. My favorite poll was done by the Gallup poll agency. They did a very clever poll and repeated it a few times in the fall, where they asked precisely the same questions to Americans in 2014 that they had asked about the H1N1 swine flu in 2009. When they posed the same identical questions about the flu in 2009. It was March, and we already had about 200,000 people in America infected with a flu that we weren't sure how dangerous it was. We weren't sure how virulent it would prove to be, and it was spreading rapidly across America. When they asked the surveys in September and October in the United States, we had only two human beings that had been infected, both missionaries that had come home for treatment. And then in their second poll set, we had the Thomas Duncan case with the two additional nurses. What's striking is that they had identical results. So at a time when we actually had more than 200,000 people infected, if you ask the question, do you believe, fill in the blank, the disease will overrun America, the exact same percentage of the American people thought the country would be overrun by flu in 2009 as by Ebola in 2014. They were right about flu. They were completely wrong about Ebola.
So what accounts for the difference in the way that they were treated? Perhaps the mortality rate of Ebola?
Well, Ebola has a very high mortality rate. It's also a frightening disease, and in the case of how Americans responded, frightening by virtue of being unknown, being a mystery. Flu, everybody has had flu, and so they can make a personal judgment. Do I believe this is a worse flu than usual or a regular flu? Do I think it's dangerous for me to get and not get vaccinated? You know, what have you. Whereas Ebola, very few people, I mean, when it first started over there, I'm one of the few Americans that's probably actually seen someone with Ebola. And so the ability to sort of fill in a vision in your mind and create a nightmare is very high when it's a mystery disease. And we've seen this over and over. The American people are not unique. In this sense, all over the world, people react extremely against the new disease, the danger of the mystery, whether you're talking about the Black Death in the 14th century or 1918 flu or HIV. But what was striking to me was just how extremely disproportionate, in the case of Ebola in America, the response of the population was compared to the actual threat.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we're primed to a certain extent. We see in the popular media, in Hollywood, in books, in movies, in TV shows, zombie apocalypse shows. That is the theme, and it's always a virus that gets loose that causes the end of the world. The uptick in popular culture perhaps tying in here to the over-the-top reaction to Ebola?
I don't think so. I think people know how to put that in a separate box. I honestly think that there's something very visceral. It's in our DNA to be afraid of diseases. And I've seen it in every single culture. I just think that what makes it different now compared to perhaps 50 years ago is the intensity of media coverage 24/7, fill in the air with something, and you can't fill in the air with calming people. You got to fill in the air with screaming and yelling. I will say, however, and I mean this quite ardently, most of the mainstream media did a very good job. I mean, whether you're talking about the New York Times and the Washington Post, the wire services, NPR, down the list, and the NewsHour on PBS, and actually a lot of the network coverage was really, really quite good. And I felt there was an attempt to calm people down. The problem is that there's a subset of our population that spends hours every day listening to rant and rave talk radio and talk TV and or cruises the Internet and always goes to the most extreme voices on the Internet.
A few more minutes with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Lori Garrett. Let's switch topics to another health topic in our news. What are your thoughts about the vaccine debate that took place last month? A couple of national political figures having to backpedal for comments after a backlash. Chris Christie, they're saying that the government should balance parental choice about vaccines in the interest of public health. After that, Senator Ron Rand Paul talking about, quote, many tragic cases of normal children who wound up with profound mental disorders after vaccines, a completely false statement there. Your thoughts while hearing that debate unfold, watching it unfold?
Well, Let's start with Chris Christie, because I already told you I thought the most egregious political act was placing Casey Hickox in that parking lot tent during the Ebola epidemic. And at the time, Christie, the governor of New Jersey, said no amount of risk is tolerable when I have to protect the people of New Jersey. And then when it came to measles vaccine, he said exactly the opposite. The risk of people contracting measles has to be weighed against the right of personal choice about vaccination. These were two quote-unquote public health decisions made by a governor with obviously no background in public health that were absolutely contradictory to one another. And I think what is completely missing in the political discussion when it ends up being about whether or not people have a right of personal choice, just as does one have a right to be drunk and carrying a loaded weapon at the same time, or does one have a right to be drunk and driving a car full speed down an Iowa highway? These are public health choices where we say for the good of the population as a whole, the individual's alleged rights have to be curbed. You don't have a right to drive drunk down the street full speed ahead on an Iowa highway. If the highway patrol catches you, the law is on their side in pulling you out of that vehicle and arresting you for drunk driving. And you don't have a right to be drunk and shooting a weapon in the air in the middle of Cedar Rapids. You also don't have a right to decline to participate in efforts to create herd immunity, which protects the population as a whole on the basis of some crazy thing you read on the internet that every single physician you talk to is going to refute, alleging that the vaccine will give your child autism or brain damage or fill in the blank with all the allegations that are made. I just find the whole thing absurd and deeply disturbing. On this issue as well, I receive a lot of hate social media directed at me. One in particular has been a drumbeat put out by I'm not sure which group, because the group won't identify itself, just the individuals tweet and Facebook and what have you, claiming that measles is actually a harmless disease. A shocking thing for me to see anybody say, since I've actually had a child die in my arms of measles and seen it devastate African children in the day before mass vaccination campaigns across Africa when it was the number one killer of children under 5 years of age on the African continent. And to say, to reach a point where we have that level of big lie, you know, right up there with saying there's no such thing as getting cancer from tobacco, or, you know, there's no safety margin provided by wearing a helmet on a motorcycle, or whatever other crazy thing you want to say. It's just staggering to me. And actually, at this moment, we have a very large epidemic of measles in Germany, in particular in Berlin, but really all over the country. And it directly correlates with a plummet in parental choice to vaccinate their children, to such a degree that in some subsets of the German population, successful full vaccination schedule, completing the entire schedule of all of the six major child preventable diseases, is at less than 20%, virtually guaranteeing the return of these diseases across Germany. And we've seen similar outbreaks in many places in Europe, in the UK, and of course, all over the place in the United States.
We're only 2 months, a little over 2 months into 2015, but it sounds like you're saying the measles could be the public health scare for 2015, the scare of the year.
Well, I'm not sure. The good news is that so many people are stepping forward finally, and prominent individuals saying, "You have got to be kidding," refusing to vaccinate your children based on this gobbledygook. And I think people are starting to look at the demographic distribution. What are the communities where people are refusing to vaccinate? All right, really rich people, upper middle class communities where people have high levels of education, tend to be Caucasian, tend to come from college-educated, upper-middle-class backgrounds. They are the ones leading the charge and declining to get vaccinated. It's communities like Marin County, California, Newport Beach, California. And I think the rest of the country is looking at this, scratching their heads and saying, what in the world is going on here? This isn't about what our problem was in the 1980s when we had resurgent measles and so on, and it was because underprivileged children in desperately poor communities didn't have access to vaccination. No, this is the people who should know better.
Okay, but
Lori
Garrett, we have just a few seconds left, but tell us why. Why this seeming contradiction? Well-educated, affluent people ignoring what you say is common sense science.
I think Jimmy Kimmel did a great piece on this, and I recommend for everybody to go Google Jimmy Kimmel and vaccines. He said, look, these are people who think they're smarter than their doctor. They think they know more than somebody who went through 12 years of medical training and residency. They think they know better than their pediatrician, or they seek out one of a handful of pediatricians around the country that has bought this crazy idea that there's something wrong with vaccines. This is the same as saying, deciding that you need to be on a gluten-free diet based on nothing more than a personal choice. That's fine. Go ahead. Be on a gluten-free diet. That, at least, only affects you. But deciding your child cannot be vaccinated because of whatever is the same level of data that you've used for your choice to go gluten-free is endangering all the other children in that child's school.
Lori Garrett,
and that you don't have a right to do.
Lori Garrett, thank you for the conversation this half hour. We have to go. Senior fellow for the Global Health Council on Foreign Relations. Look forward to welcoming you to Iowa here in the coming month.
Thank you, Iowa.
All right. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.